court is ready to hear argument now in 080379 in the interest of JOA and others.
May I please the court? Mr. Woodruff will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court? Your Honors, although seemingly complex, the two issues before the court today boil down into two relatively simple questions. Number one, whether Family Code Section 263.405 will be applied as written. And number two, whether longstanding case law establishing that endangering conduct by a parent against a child sibling can be used as endangering conduct against that child will be replaced with a new holding finding that there must be endangering conduct as to each child. As this court knows, Family Code Section 263.405 is the post-trial procedure set forth by the legislature in parental rights termination cases. It requires the appealing party to file a statement of points on which they intend to appeal within 15 days of the trial court signing of its order. It requires the appealing party to hold a hearing before the trial court to present those issues within 30 days. And it requires that the appellate court may not consider any issue not included in a timely filed statement of points. Of course, the problem in this case was that the parents, in this case, had timely appointed counsel, but counsel failed to file the statement of points. Thus, the appellate court was precluded from considering the issues.
What if there had?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What if there had not been timely appointed counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think that was going into my next statement, which is I'm not sure that the statute really deals with ineffective assistance of counsel or whether counsel was appointed. I think the question deals with how the statute handles that issue. And I think the answer is that those issues are precluded.
So even if counsel had not been appointed, which we've had cases that in which that was the case.
Yes, sir.
Still you couldn't, and no statement of points was filed, still you couldn't appeal.
Well, I want to clarify something, Justice Hecht. Is Your Honor speaking about cases where indigent counsel is not appointed?
Yes.
That may boil down into a different question. That was the question before this court in SKA. That very well may result in a due process violation. Fortunately, we don't have that issue before the court today.
How can you raise it if it seemed to me your position is pretty absolute, that if it's not in the statement of points, it's just not an issue on appeal?
That's correct, Your Honor, because that's what the statute reads. This court has held that due process concerns comport with this court's rules of error preservation. The Amarillo court in this very opinion stated that 263.405 is a prerequisite to the court's authority to consider issues. As this court knows, we're dealing with a statutory right of appeal in this case. As the right of appeal is statutory, this court held that the legislature has the right to deny, restrict, or limit that right of appeal in whatever manner they see fit. As we're dealing with that statutory right, 263.405 is nothing more
It's not as they seem fit. If there's a violation of someone's constitutional due process rights, I mean, we're not going to let that slide.
Well, Your Honor, I would liken the issue to a situation where you have highly ineffective counsel, and they failed to file the notice of appeal within the 35-day requirement, being the 20 days for the notice of appeal and the 15-day Burke extension. Under that situation, you couldn't appeal that either. This statute is jurisdictional in effect, and that its purpose is to avoid needless appeals, not avoid all appeals, but avoid needless appeals. If this court enunciates that ineffective assistance of counsel can be used to step around that hurdle, then the statute is frustrated. Its purpose isn't met. There's no need to follow the statute.
There's another statute, and the other statute says you have a right to counsel.
Yes, sir.
So it looks to me like if you don't have effective assistance of counsel, you're frustrating that statute.
Well, Your Honor,
that's what we basically held in In Re MS.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are two things I would answer that. First, in In Re MS, the court was dealing with a court-made rule requiring error preservation of factual sufficiency reviews in jury trial cases. Here we are dealing with a specific statute, which this court held the legislature has the right to promulgate statutes to set forth the preservation requirements. And number two, Your Honor, in MS, the court was dealing with a situation where it can be beneficial to file that motion for new trial. If you don't file a motion for new trial, you can't get a new trial. In this case, if you don't file your statement of points, the only thing that results is error preclusion. There's no benefit to following the statute absent a consequence. When you look
at... Well, that's quite a...
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Error preclusion is quite a consequence, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, but time and time again in BLD and JFC, this court has held that error preclusion does not necessarily violate due process. When this court or the legislature promulgates rules, they have to have some bite to them and be followed.
But what we said was, however, if it precludes you from having a meritorious issue on appeal heard, that raises due process concerns.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but once again, I would return to the fact that we are dealing with a statute here which sets forth the procedural requirements to preserve that issue.
Statutes. It sounds like kind of like a catch-22. You know, you can't complain on appeal of ineffective assistance of counsel if you don't raise that in the statement of points. But it's not raised in the state of points because you got ineffective assistance of counsel.
You're exactly correct, Justice Hecht. And in the RN case out of Corpus Christi, out of San Antonio Court of Appeals, that was exactly the issue. The issue before the court there was whether a complaint for ineffective assistance of counsel could be brought when it wasn't included in a timely filed statement of points. The San Antonio court concluded that it could not be brought based on the clear requirements of 263.405. This court denied review. So that issue, to some extent, has been looked at by this court before.
So why did we deny review in that case? Do we know?
No, Your Honor, but since it was the only issue...
No.
I assume the court members know, Your Honor.
Yes, that's right. So what precedent does it mean? What precedential value is it that we denied review?
Well, Your Honor, because it was...
This particular issue.
Yes, sir. Justice Johnson, the only issue in that case was whether it could be brought. So I'm going to take the step and say there's at least a logical inference that as it was the only issue, this court at least chose not to consider it at that point.
But haven't we said in our opinions the denial of a petition for review does not – there are many reasons for denial of a petition for review?
In the latest several round of cases released on 263.405, this court has put that specific language in its opinion. However, there was no opinion issued in RM. I was just trying to draw the parallel for the court that that's the only case at this point that's looked at it and followed the plain language of the statute. If the court looks at the legislature's intent in this statute, the legislature specifically put in its bill analysis that appellate courts, by allowing these issues to be brought when not included in a timely filed statement of points, not only was it ignoring the process of the statute, but the courts were telling appealing parties, that there are no adverse consequences for failing to file a statement of points.
There is a right to counsel in these cases.
Yes, sir.
Correct?
Yes, sir.
And does right to counsel mean right to effective counsel in your view?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Well, then why wouldn't this be, especially when you're dealing with a constitutional issue of the parent-child relationship,
yes, sir,
a denial of counsel be a due process violation that the court would be obligated to correct?
Well, first, Your Honor, if the court wishes to step beyond the plain language of the statute and the legislature's clear intent, then if the court engages in a due process analysis under Matthews and JFC and the other cases this court's engaged in that analysis, I think the decision still falls on the side of the department. Your Honor, we are dealing here not only with the constitutional rights, as Mr. Chief Justice stated, of the parent, we're also dealing with the child's right to permanence. That was clearly enunciated as a necessary right by the Supreme Court.
Does the 15-day deadline really advance permanency? I mean, I understand the goal of the legislature, but saying you waive something in 15 days if you don't assert it, how does that truly advance the ball?
Well, I would point two things out, Justice O'Neill. First, this court has already extended that 15-day deadline in MN. So my second prong of the Matthews versus Eldridge analysis is that this court has already provided additional procedural safeguards by extending that 15-day requirement.
So we should remand this then in light of?
No, Your Honor. I would like the court to reverse and render it on the fact that ineffective assistance should never have been looked at.
Well, no, I understand that. But, I mean, if you can then move for an extension of the 15 days, there was never an opportunity to do that here.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it was never requested either, so I believe that would be a waiver issue.
Help me with the background here. What percentage of parents in these cases are indigent and have appointed counsel?
I can't give the court an exact percentage, but I would say quite a fair amount.
Almost all?
That may be a fair assessment, Justice Brister.
And is it true that almost all trial counsel then withdraw immediately after the termination?
No, I wouldn't say that's the case, Your
Looks
Honor.
Looks like a lot of them do. Why do they do it, and why do the trial courts grant it?
Your Honor, I would say that's a question for the legislature. The legislature, of course, could amend the statute to include language that counsel stay on.
But if counsel stays on, it's a little difficult for counsel to assert ineffective assistance of counsel as a point of error, isn't it?
No, sir.
Doesn't that put counsel in a conflicting position, so to speak?
That argument has been raised, Your Honor, but it's been held in AS out of Beaumont and a number of other cases that the 15-day requirement is not unconstitutional.
No. I'm just talking about trial counsel and why they're replaced. That happens fairly regularly in criminal cases, as I understand, and the reason being you might want to assert trial counsel was ineffective, and how's trial counsel going to stand up in front of an appellate court and argue I was ineffective?
That's happened, Your Honor.
Doesn't that put trial counsel in a conflicting position, and isn't that a good reason to change counsel?
Well, excuse me for interrupting, Your Honor, but that has happened before. The Bermea case that was up before this court, that's exactly what happened. Counsel failed to file a statement of points and came before the appellate court and said, I was ineffective for not doing it. Your Honor, I would point that our legislature has determined that you have a statutory right to appellate counsel in our cases. That's true. But as this is a statutory right of appeal, I think we have to balance those two issues together.
So how do we do that? That's really the burden. You can't just say all 405 or all the – how do you balance?
Well, Your Honor, since 405 is a strict procedural statute that applies directly to the question at issue, I think it sets forth what's required.
So we balance them by giving all the weight to 405.
Yes, Your Honor. But even if the court engages in that due process analysis, I think we still prevail there. If I could go back to Justice O'Neill's question, Your Honor, you asked why does this 15-day requirement advance children's permanence? It advances children's permanence because if this court sets forth that you can step aside this requirement through ineffective assistance of counsel, then the practice is established that you no longer need to follow the statute. The only way this statute works, Your Honor, is if each section is applied with equal force. There must be a timely statement of points so that there is a timely presentation of the issues before the trial court. The purpose of this statute, which I believe goes in the due process analysis, is not to prevent meritorious appeals, but to allow the trial court to correct its mistakes. In an earlier case, BLE, this court held that error preservation rules allowing the trial court to correct its mistake comport with due process because they advance the child's permanence. By allowing parents or appealing parties, because this statute applies equally to all parties in these cases, by allowing a party to step aside this statute, it's legitimate.
But not all mistakes can be corrected. We've got another case up here where the statutory deadlines ran out for final disposition, and the trial counsel made no motion to dismiss the case. Now, how's the trial court going to correct that if that's not in a statement of points? I mean, is that a rule we should do, is if it's correctable by the trial court, then it's waived? But if it's not correctable by the trial court, it's not?
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I believe by following the statute, regardless of whether it's truly correctable by the trial court, by following the statute, you meet the statute's requirements, and you're fine for an appeal.
Counsel, is there anywhere in this entire scheme that the legislature's created of termination and acceleration, expediting appeals, other than this one instance where we say a failure to file in a statement of points saying ineffective assistance of counsel, that you just don't get to assert it and it doesn't arise until later. Is there anywhere other than strictly construing this statute that you find legislative intent to preclude parents whose parental rights are terminated from having a right to at least have that reviewed by the trial court or by an appellate court, that they just don't want any appeals taking place?
I don't believe there's any other section that deals with that, Your Honor, because 263.405 is the post-trial section that deals with that. But again, I would go back to the fact that any time you have a deadline, there must be a consequence for failing to follow that deadline. And this court has held that failing to object at trial, failing to timely file notice of appeal, those issues preclude a review.
A consequence to who?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
A consequence to whom? The attorney, the child, the parent?
All
for the mistake of the attorney?
Well, in those cases, Your Honor, it results in a consequence for the parent, regardless of whether it's the attorney. And if those cases have been held to be all right by this court, then 263.405 should be dumped into that category as well. when the court's looking at due process, I would ask the court to not only consider the child's interest in this, but also the fact that the state has an interest, A, in promoting the permanence for the child, and B, the state also has an interest in ensuring that its procedures are, you know, used fairly against all, or apply fairly to all litigants in the case.
We thought we'd have that technical difficulty corrected, so
give you
please.
20 more minutes.
Yes.
I'll use it, Your Honor.
Continue in disregard to the extent you can. It's not an emergency.
Let's see if I can get back to my train of thought.
Mm-hmm. You're right, and your time is up. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Do you give up on D with respect to, subparagraph D with respect to termination of Terry's interest in the twins?
I'm sorry.
With respect to Terry, the termination of Terry's interest in the twins.
Yes, sir.
Does the state give up on ground D? I think the trial court terminated on the grounds of D and E.
Yes, sir.
You give up on D?
No, sir, I wouldn't.
How could D apply when he never was around after the twins were born?
Your Honor, the case law in this area is very specific that endangering conduct towards other children, siblings, can be used against.
And you make that argument under E.
Yes, sir.
But you also make it under D.
Yes, sir. I don't believe there's any case law that precludes that. If the court wishes to turn to the legal sufficiency review, I believe the Amarillo court entirely misread this court's clear pronouncement of the legal sufficiency review in that case. The evidence before the case, before the court of trial court in that case, dealt with father, I believe his name was Timothy, Your Honor. He admitted to missing two drug screens. He admitted that he was aware that drug screens were ordered and they are prerequisite to reunification. He admitted to testing positive for marijuana the month before trial. And he admitted that the mother was using cocaine during pregnancy and he knew it.
And counsel, if there are no further questions, you can return to that subject in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And the court is ready to hear argument now from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. McDonough will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. When egregious wrong occurs, however, and we are barred from correcting it due to application of a statute to situations which most likely no one intended, our legal system has failed in that instance. That was Chief Justice Quinn in the interest of R.C. out of Amarillo. What we have here is an instant that I'm certain legislature didn't intend. No attorneys intended.
Well, are you sure they didn't intend it? Because courts had tried to get around it before, some of the appellate courts, and legislature seemed to make it real clear courts aren't following this, so we're going to make it airtight.
If that is the case, Your Honor.
I mean, that is the case.
Yeah, I mean, if the legislature intended to put such an obstacle to the extent that even constitutional regards would be thrown out the window, then certainly the law has failed in this instance.
Well, just the idea of a 15-day deadline, so there's nothing unconstitutional about that.
In and of itself, no, Your Honor.
So why aren't people doing it?
Your Honor, I would answer the question in a number of ways. I think you're dealing with a number of attorneys who, in fact, don't know that statute exists. I think that you're dealing with a number of attorneys, and I think in this case as well, you're dealing with attorneys who have done exactly what the justice have asked. Why are so many people withdrawing? Well, that's the point. A number of people, especially in the district where we are practicing in the Panhandle, a number of people are trial attorneys, and that's what they're used to. They're used to being in a trial setting, and so they will argue up to the point of trial, and once that's over, they want out. And I think a lot of people don't understand that as trial counsel, you have to go further, that you have to represent them. And I think in this case, in fact, that's what happened to Timothy Murphy. He was represented by trial counsel, and yet at the point of filing the motion withdrawal and the notice of appeal, it was as if counsel was gone.
Is there a financial incentive to get out?
Is there a
Is it the lawyer just doesn't want to handle appellate cases?
Your Honor, I think that there is. I would answer this way. I think that more people are unqualified and are unwilling to put the effort into doing a brief, arguing for the Court of Appeals.
But we're really only talking about a list of points.
We are, Your Honor.
I don't mind if they don't want to do the brief, but we've got 15 days here. The switching horses is very difficult in that amount of time. Nobody knows better than trial counsel the things you objected to and the trial judge overruled you on. And all you have to do is send in a list of points saying the trial judge did these things wrong, these three things wrong.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor.
Isn't the rule you're arguing for, though, going to discourage? It's going to encourage people to quit. Because if you get your trial attorney to quit and then get a new trial attorney, you're going to get a lot longer period to appeal and everything's going to be held up.
No, I don't think it will, because I think that in the instant case, had a notice of or a motion to withdraw been filed on the day of the judgment and hearing being held at that time, then I think the new attorney would have had more time to speak with his counsel, would have had time to speak with the
very unlikely would have been able to read the record.
Absolutely, and in fact, we.
So isn't, yeah, I mean, from just, forget about the legislature, if we were just trying to set this up and all we legislature told us to get it done in 15 days, we'd be best off with a rule that said trial counsel can't quit until after they file their statement of points. That's the person who knows best, who's best able to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, and this statute has not provided any of those safeguards.
Is there any sort of avenue to file any kind of an Anders brief in this context where someone can just say there are no points for appeal in good faith, or is that just not done in this area?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, an Anders brief is an open avenue. It's available. Again, I would say that for counsel would be an easy way out. If all counsel got in the habit of simply saying, well, I'm going to file an Anders brief, that's a fairly simple brief, I can look for one or two points, or I'll just file legal and factual sufficiency, knowing that the statute says that's not allowed.
Obviously, one of the concerns appears to be that getting around the statute by an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. How would you carve out a rule that would preclude a hole so wide that the rule swallowed up?
Your Honor, I think that the 30-day window, or make it contingent upon the filing of the record, or you can make it contingent upon a day limitation.
Filing of the record with?
Or completion of the reporter's record.
But we're already in MN. The legislature said 15 days, and Justice Willett says, y'all are just ignoring the legislature's 15 days and tacking on 15 more. And now you're saying we ought to tack on some more. We ought to tack on some more for the record and this, that, and the other. I mean, there's so far we can go, and then we have to start wondering about our own role in separation of powers.
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact, on behalf of my client, I would argue that certainly we want that window to be as far as we can, give us more time to argue. I think there are safeguards, though, that this court could put in place through this constitutional issue.
Like what? Safeguards.
You can make, well, one, if you go to the 30-day window, the 20-day window is when you have a notice of appeal. Obviously, if this statute had a requirement that in fact that was up to trial counsel, that trial counsel before withdrawal is permitted.
What in this process or in the rules requires the trial court or the lawyer to advise the parents that they have 15 days in which to file these points?
The professional license that they hold, Your Honor.
And there's nothing, for example, in the when the judge signs the order terminating the rights, there's nothing that requires that judge to let counsel know or the parties or anyone that there is a limited time to preserve appellate rights.
There is no requirement.
Well, now, wait a second. If they withdraw, they do.
If they withdraw,
If you're going to withdraw, you have to notify the client in writing of pending deadlines.
The problem with that in the present case, that is correct, Your Honor. You are required to advise them of impending deadlines. However, in the present case, a motion to withdraw was filed on February 21st, the day after judgment, and there was no order on it. So the question is, at what point was he withdrawn? The only time that you could say that an order came down in which he was actually withdrawn by the court was the date on which appellate counsel was appointed. So in that respect, who now has to advise the client of the deadlines and the rights under those deadlines?
But it's true, factually, trial court signed a termination order. At that point, the appointed counsels for both parents filed a motion to withdraw, which was left for about 2.5 weeks pending. So during the entire 15-day period, they were still counsel. They had filed a motion to withdraw, but the motion hadn't been granted. So during this entire 15-day window to file their statement of points, they were still the appointed counsel of record, weren't they?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in that respect, that is the ineffective assistance of counsel. Under this statute, the statute, if you look only at the plain language says that doesn't matter. That it doesn't matter that an individual has a constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel. Now, obviously, you would have to apply the Strickland standard there. Should an attorney who has been appointed to represent this client, who has not been withdrawn by order of the court, then continue to advise? Or is it reasonable to say that, no, the attorney should neglect this statute? And in this case, if you overlook the fact that there was no other way that this appeal could be heard, if you only look at the plain wording of the statute and the plain meaning of the statute, it precludes it all.
Would it be appropriate for the court in analyzing this case to look at the merits? What if the court were to look at the merits and determine there is no even conceivable legal ground upon which the trial court's decision would be reversed? Then we wouldn't get to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Is that correct or not?
Your Honor, I would say that it would probably be closer the other way. If you didn't have ineffective assistance of counsel, you would never have to get to the merits. I actually, although I think if you found that there was no merit, yes, there wouldn't be any ineffective assistance of counsel because they would have had no right to appeal.
Then maybe you ought to spend just a few moments talking about the merits of your argument here.
And that would be under the factual and legal sufficiency, Your Honor. What was created here under the clear and convincing evidence standard was a carrot and a stick. Your Honor, for Timothy Murphy, what happened was in the original trial in August of 2007, the testimony was that he had a number of problems. There was some testimony about marijuana use. The record is unclear as to whether when the daily use occurred. At one time he was asked a question and the statement was, yes, I used while I was in California. His mother later testified that he was using when he was younger, when he had been arrested for robbery. So it's unclear as to where the marijuana use was. Clearly, the court did not think in August of 2007 it had sufficient grounds to terminate. And therefore, it gave Timothy Murphy and Trina Murphy the opportunity to continue. And in fact, it gave the order that they would have to continue services, that they would have to submit to drug testing. Timothy Murphy submitted to drug testing and came up clean. The problem in that scenario is that they've put this stick out there with a carrot on it saying, look, you follow all of these, you go another 6 months, we'll extend it, and you'll have the right, you'll have your children back. There's a good opportunity you'll have your children back. Well, in the February hearing, that's not what happened. The problem for the factual sufficiency is that there is no more marijuana use. He has shown that he had worked. He had shown that he had provided a housing. Now, there was great questions about, well, why are you moving around so much? But then CPS testified that, well, we required you to move to a 3-bedroom house, and so that's what he did. They said, well, you can't be moving from job to job because that's a stability issue. But then they told him, you've got to make more money. It's not enough money. You got to support your kids. The issue of child support. At the first hearing in August of 2007, Timothy Murphy, there was testimony that he had only paid $601. However, he testified that it was all coming out of his checks, and they said, we don't have any records of that. Now, when CPS testified in the February 2008 hearing, the final hearing, CPS testified that, yes, there were records that money was being taken out of his check, but we're not sure what those records are. In fact, what they've done is they've said, well, you followed everything pretty well, but we're going to hold what Trina did against you, Timothy, because she used cocaine at a time that she had told you that those were probably not your kids, at a time that she had had you arrested on a false charge, and she admitted that on the stand. And what we're going to do is, because you permitted her and knew she was using cocaine at that time, when the testimony was she'd only used it that one time during pregnancy, we're going to hold that one fact against Timothy Murphy. And we're going to say that that in itself is sufficient to show that you endangered your children.
Isn't it some evidence? You don't think it's any evidence at all?
Your Honor, in this case, I think it would be some evidence, but if it was some evidence, it would have been some evidence in August of 2007. Yeah. But I think that the span from August of 2007 to February of 2008 negated whatever value that evidence was.
But if it was, so you don't, it's not just that it's factually insufficient, you think there was no evidence at all?
I think there was no evidence.
If there was some evidence, then it has to go back to the Court of Appeals, I guess. The case does. If we get past this ineffective assistance of counsel issue.
Yes. I believe it.
Because obviously, if they thought there was no evidence, they thought the evidence was factually insufficient.
And I don't know that their opinion is clear on that, Your Honor.
Their opinion is pretty clear. There's no evidence.
Right. And I think in the balancing test, in the test that they do, I would agree with Your Honor that they have said that there is no evidence. No clear and convincing evidence.
So Timothy's rights to the twins can't be terminated, according to the Court of Appeals. And now custody is still an issue. They sent it back for custody determination.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But if they're wrong about no evidence, then they would have to reconsider factual sufficiency.
Not necessarily, because they still have to write the...
Well, then there'd be a new trial. If there was,
right.
If the evidence is factually insufficient, then Timothy would get a new trial.
That is correct. And that to determine if there was
not
clear
just
and
on
convincing
best,
evidence.
Not just on best interest, but on termination.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so, in this case, as far as the legal and factual sufficiency is concerned, I think that whatever evidence value there was, it would have had to be acted on upon the court at the time that it was before the court. But to permit a parent in a relationship with a child to go forward 6 months and for him to continue the plan as was ordered of him and yet to say what you did 9 months ago is what we're going to is what we're actually going to terminate you on, I think that's insufficient evidence. And in fact, it's basically saying what CPS's purpose is to prove you're a bad parent and not to assist you in regaining that relationship with your child. And I think that would be egregious in this case, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, if I may go back to the Chief Justice's question regarding looking at the merits, 263-405 was designed to avoid that process. Justice O'Neill, you mentioned creating a hole in the statute. If this court reviews ineffective assistance and goes to the merits, that's exactly what the statute is designed against. That's exactly what it will drive counsel to do. It is a better practice to ignore the statute, claim ineffective assistance, and bring any issue you want on appeal. Also, Your Honor, I would point out that there is a form of collateral attack in these cases. A bill of review has not been explored yet. I know Amarillo mentioned a writ of quorum nobis. I'm not entirely sure that a failure to properly preserve an appeal here entirely denies a parent or an appealing party from the right to go back to the trial court, ask for a new trial, and then appeal that bill of review finding. It was in Amarillo, it was the Amarillo Court of Appeals in RCC and RCC Junior, Your Honors, that stated that creating fabricating an interpretation of the statute that destroys it is blatant legislating from the bench. Ignoring the statute's clear mandate, I think, is ignoring the legislature's power to promulgate and enforce those statutes.
What is the clear and convincing evidence that you think warrants termination of Timothy's rights and rights?
I would turn to the drug use, the missed drug tests, and the admission that he knew of the cocaine use. Also,
of his wife's?
Yes, Your Honor, of his wife's cocaine use during pregnancy. Also, all the endangering conduct, all the times he kicked the mother out of the home and knew the child was with her, all the times he knew that the mother went on cocaine binges and he left the child with her, that's all endangering conduct. Turning to this court's holdings in J.P.
Really not. The Court of Appeals had trouble with that because it was not directed at the twins, because they were taken away from the mother the moment they were born.
I don't think that's the status of the law, Your Honor. In Robinson, Dupree, it's been held that drug use, even before a child's birth, can be endangering conduct. In JPB and MLI, this court held that the trial court is the arbiter of the credibility, the demeanor of the witnesses. There's no precedent to negate endangering conduct existing at an initial trial, and then somehow after a continuance, it disappears and it's no longer endangering. There's no precedent for that. And going back to Justice Johnson's question earlier, we don't know why the trial court granted a continuance. We can't assume that it's because the court found the evidence insufficient. At the end of the day, after considering the evidence, the trial court judge was in the trial judge's chair, heard the testimony, saw the demeanor of the witnesses, and determined that the statutory termination grounds were met. The evidence was clear and convincing. If you look at the evidence in light of the fact finder's judgment, you resolve all disputed evidence in favor of the fact finder's judgment, this evidence is legally sufficient, and it should be remanded for a factual sufficiency consideration. If the court looks at the Amarillo court's discussion, it looks at best interest. It talks about dad's parenting ability. It talks about dad's employment. It talks about dad's support at church. Those are Holly versus Adams factors in the best interest. The Amarillo court never got past the initial question of the statutory termination grounds. Therefore, I think this case needs to be remanded if the court moves past the ineffective assistance. But once again, I would remind the court that by doing that, I think it will become the practice of appellants, of appealing parties, to totally miss filing the statement of points in order to claim ineffective, because that actually advances your client's right in a very roundabout and absurd way. It becomes effective to avoid the statute.
Your position would be that if the legislature wants to grant the right to assert ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to file a statement of points, then it can do so in the statute, and I presume.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what would that look like in your view? Have you even thought of any structure when the legislature might terminate that to keep the accelerated process going forward here and yet afford a right to assert ineffective assistance for failing to file a statement?
Well, I think, Justice Johnson, they could have simply added that to the statute. But once again, looking at the language they used, which is it's assumed they intended to use, it says any. And again, I would remind the court that the court's already provided a procedural safeguard in the fact that a 15-day extension has already been granted in the MN case. So again, I think if due process is reached, we reach a different calibration than in the MS case.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.